Never shot my son on purpose. I didn't even know the gun was loaded. It was an accident. I feel like I don't even think I should live. No, I want you to live.
Hank Earl Carr was articulating his suicidal thoughts to crisis negotiator Marissa Bell Kelly while holed up inside a gas station outside Brooksville 20 years ago. During a 10-hour span, Carr had murdered a 4-year-old boy, fatally gunned down 3 law enforcement officers, held a pregnant gas station clerk hostage, and then took his own life. Details of that carnage-filled day are coming up on Sun Crime State. I'm Tony Holt, crime reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Welcome to Sun Crime State, a weekly podcast that takes an in-depth look at Florida's biggest crime stories of the past and present. In this episode, I'll discuss the murder of Butch Singer, a legally blind 48-year-old Bunnell man whose mothball-covered body was found underneath a John boat on his property in February 2017. The victim's wife, Dorothy Singer, was convicted of his murder. On Friday, a judge sentenced her to life in prison. Later, I'll dive into the Tampa area rampage from May 19, 1998 that spread across 40 miles and led to the deaths of 5 people. Hank Earl Carr had shot his girlfriend's 4-year-old boy in the head and drove the boy to a local fire station. In the aftermath of that tragedy, Carr killed 2 Tampa police detectives and then a Florida state trooper who had pulled him over on Interstate 75. The day of violence ended just before sundown when Carr took his own life, just as a SWAT unit moved in to arrest him inside a rural gas station. My special guest for that segment will be retired Hernando County Sheriff's crisis negotiator Marissa Bell Kelly, retired Tampa Police Detective Dan Grassi, former Tampa Tribune reporter Sarah Huntley, and Florida Highway Patrol Sergeant Steve Gaskins. Coming up, the story of the trial of Dorothy Singer.
He had the gun in his hand and was pulling me by the hair. He snatched the blanket and pillow off the couch and pulled me by the back of my hair and made me walk out to the hog cage, telling me he was going to put me in the hog cage and leave me.
That was Florida County Sheriff's crime scene investigator Lainey Rittenour reading a suicide letter written by Dorothy Singer while testifying on the stand during Singer's first-degree murder trial. The letter depicted Singer as the victim of an abusive marriage. She claimed her husband, Charles Butch Singer, killed himself accidentally, and she blacked out. When she came to, she buried his body instead of contacting authorities. Dorothy Singer didn't commit suicide, and jurors did not buy her story. After 5 years of deliberations, they returned with a guilty verdict, and Singer was sentenced to life in prison. The state attorney's office did not pursue the death penalty against the 53-year-old. In her letter, Singer described 3 days of arguments and abuse that led to her husband's death. She said her husband pulled her off the couch by her hair and then dragged her outside to the hog pen in the backyard. Singer claimed that her husband fired a round from his gun at her feet in an effort to make her get in the hog pen. But there was a struggle over the weapon, and that's when it went off and a bullet entered her husband's chest. This according to Singer's letter. Her husband actually suffered 5 gunshot wounds, including 4 in the head. Another crime scene analyst also testified last week that a blood sample was found on the headboard in the couple's master bedroom. The blood came from Butch Singer. Detectives had spent weeks looking for the victim. The entire time, Dorothy Singer stuck to her story that her husband had moved out following an argument. She claimed she didn't know where he was. Eventually, authorities found the body. It was located in what was described by the medical examiner as a clandestine grave on the couple's property. He had been wrapped in bedding and buried beneath tarps, debris, and a John boat in a wooded area along Pine Tree Lane. When she was arrested, Singer had $733 in cash on her, and it had appeared she was planning to fake her death and leave the country. Her car was found abandoned near the Matanzas Inlet in neighboring St. Johns County. Prosecutor Jennifer Dunton told jurors that Singer had a penchant for dishonesty and that the evidence contradicted the defendant's lies. For instance, there was no way the gun would have simply gone off during a struggle because it was a single-action revolver. The hammer had to be cocked back each time before it could be fired. Additionally, the gun only held 5 rounds. So how was it that Butch Singer fired 1 round at her feet, only to have 5 rounds fired into him? Denton asked that question of Dorothy Singer while she was on the stand, testifying in her own defense. Singer backtracked her claim that her husband fired a warning shot at her feet. Singer claimed she had blacked out and couldn't remember any details of the shooting for nearly 3 months. She also couldn't recall buying the mothballs or purchasing the camouflage tarp at a hardware store days after her husband's death. Denton addressed one more act of deception on the part of the defendant. Cell phone records revealed she had used her husband's phone for weeks after he was killed in an effort to cause people to think he was still alive. The slaying of Butch Singer was one of 5 homicides that occurred last year in Flagler, which is the most that small county has recorded in 1 calendar year, dating back to the mid-90s. Coming up, the story of Hank Earl Carr and the violence he inflicted all by himself across the Tampa region 20 years ago.
I've never experienced anything like that before in my life. I've seen a lot of bad things, being a policeman and being in homicide. But when you have 2 friends that you walk up and you see that, yeah, it was by far the worst day of my life.
Dan Grossi was a sergeant assigned to the homicide unit at the Tampa Police Department in 1998. 2 of his detectives, Randy Bell and Rick Childers, were killed in the line of duty. Moments later, their killer, child murder suspect Hank Earl Carr, fatally shot rookie Florida Highway Patrol trooper James Crooks near an exit ramp on Interstate 75 in Pasco County. The day ended with Carr taking his own life inside a Shell station on State Road 50, east of Brooksville. He had just freed his hostage, a 27-year-old pregnant cashier. He fired the bullet through his own skull just before a SWAT team blew out a wall using explosives and entered the building. After the siege ended, May 19, 1998, marked the darkest day for the Tampa Bay metropolitan region since the Sunshine Skyway Bridge disaster of 1980. Sarah Huntley was a police reporter at the Tampa Tribune. She spent a lot of time covering Carr's 3-county rampage and its aftermath. She spent 15 years in the newspaper business before leaving the industry in 2000, and she told me that no other event she covered during her career lingered in her mind longer than that one.
One of the things with a story like this, as you well know, is that the reverberations last for a long, long time. Obviously, in this case, it did, because here it is 20 years later, and we're talking about it. So it's not a one-and-done kind of assignment by any means.
And it all started with the shooting death of a 4-year-old boy, the son of Carr's live-in girlfriend, a child he regularly abused, along with the boy's 5-year-old sister, according to neighbors who spoke to the media. To understand how such a series of gut-wrenching and heartbreaking developments could occur between sunrise and sundown on that random day 20 years ago, one must be familiar with the long, violent history of Hank Carr. Born in 1968 in Atlanta, Carr spent most of his life in Florida and Ohio. By the time he entered adulthood, he was making regular visits to the local jail. from 1985 through 1990. He was arrested a total of 22 times, mostly in Sarasota County. Carr had a short temper. He had a love of firearms, and he loved to intimidate people. He once stomped a puppy to death in front of some children. He once bit off a portion of a man's ear during a barroom brawl. While in Ohio, he was questioned in a fatal stabbing of an 18-year-old female. No one was arrested in that case, and Carr's blood sample couldn't be matched to any of the evidence at the crime scene. The victim's body was found in September 1992 in a cemetery about 2 miles from Carr's home in Marietta, Ohio. Even though he couldn't be forensically linked to the homicide, police never officially ruled him out as a suspect. Detectives who worked that case in Ohio and were interviewed by the Tampa Tribune said Carr had a reputation for fighting and defying authority. He seemed to relish having the reputation of being unpredictable. He could be destructive without warning. Carr's love for guns was nearly equaled by his love of martial arts. His friends always walked a tightrope with him, preferring to avoid any confrontations. Carr was always losing jobs, so while he was unemployed, he decided to make ends meet by selling guns. Neighbors said he kept a lot of firearms in his apartment, even though he owned them illegally due to his convicted felon status. He would randomly fire off rounds on the property, and Carr would sometimes be seen with a handgun tucked inside his waistband. He'd shoot at rodents, mostly squirrels. Neighbors assumed he wasn't operating with a full deck. While living in Florida, he served a few short stints in prison. He was convicted in 1986, 1988, and 1989. His offenses included burglary, forgery, grand theft, cocaine possession, and battery on a law enforcement officer. He didn't hide his hatred of cops. He used to talk openly about wanting to exchange gunfire with police or instigate a manhunt culminating in violence. Carr's last home was an apartment on East Crenshaw Street in Tampa. The 30-year-old shared the apartment with his 24-year-old girlfriend, Bernice Bowen, and her children, 4-year-old Joey Bennett and 5-year-old Kayla Bennett. A downstairs neighbor was so bothered by the way he mistreated Bowen and her children that he called the Department of Children and Families on Carr. The agency confirmed to the media that a case had been opened on him. Caseworkers showed up to the home, but Carr wasn't there. But they had planned to return. At one point, Carr was suspected of intentionally dropping Joey on his head. That was the boy's punishment for wetting himself. Joey was shot and killed the morning of May 19th, 1998. It was a Tuesday. According to the St. Petersburg Times, one of Carr's neighbors watched in horror as Joey's 5-year-old sister ran to her, covered in blood. The girl said, "My daddy shot my baby brother, and he's not breathing." Carr and Bowen didn't have a phone in their apartment, so they couldn't call 911. They drove Joey, who was bleeding profusely from his head and face, to a fire station on North Nebraska Avenue, which was about a mile away from their apartment. The couple pulled up to the station shortly before 10 a.m. and carried the child inside. Bowen was pleading with firefighters to save her son. By then, the boy had no pulse and wasn't breathing. Paramedics could not save him. As soon as Carr heard the boy was dead, he got into his car and sped away. He returned to his apartment on East Crenshaw, and that's where police caught up with him. Among those who responded was Dan Grossi. He remembers Carr was not interested in coming clean about what he had done.
Well, we got a call that there was a baby had been shot and was at a fire station. And I stopped at the fire station, and then I went up to the address on Crenshaw. I sent detectives to the fire station. I sent detectives to the house. And then when I got to the house, I was walking up, and I saw this guy running. And I would, I just said, "Who is that?" And they go, "Well, that's the suspect." So they, he ran a couple blocks, and some uniformed guys caught him and brought him back. And then they took him down to the police department, up to the homicide division.
car ran away while detectives were questioning him. Police at the time were investigating Joey's death as an accidental shooting. Obviously, Carr's attempts to escape aroused their suspicions. They found him to be squirrely. That's the word the Tampa police spokesman used when he addressed the media that morning. The media were already asking questions after word got out about the deceased 4-year-old boy who was driven to the fire station. Huntley was among those media members who drove to Carr's address.
So I responded early on in the event after we heard that the mother and boyfriend had brought the child to the fire department and that he had been declared dead or deceased at the scene. That was obviously news in and of itself. It was a tragic situation, and I was on my way out the door immediately after hearing the information come over the scanner. So I went to the home. I remember it being a semi-rural street with a lot of shady trees. It was a hot day. The house was back behind, sort of on the back end of a lot, so it was difficult to see the actual home where the shooting had occurred. But I was in the front part of the lot and immediately began trying to talk to neighbors and officers who were at the scene about what had happened.
Carr was transported to police headquarters. For a while, he acted like a willing suspect. He agreed to be interviewed and answered questions. He even feigned emotion.
He was cooperative, and he was in the office. He was handcuffed. They did an interview with him, and he basically admitted it, but he said it was an accident. He put on a great act, actually. He was tearful, and he said he didn't mean to do it and couldn't believe it happened. I think they were going to charge him with manslaughter at the time.
Once it seemed Carr had regained his poise, Detectives Randy Bell and Rick Childers decided they would take him back to the home where he would reenact the shooting and help them piece together what had happened.
They brought him to homicide. They did an interview with him, and then they took him back to the scene, which was a practice that we did occasionally. If somebody was cooperative, we would sometimes bring them back and walk through something so it was clear to everybody. And they brought him back to the scene at the house on Crenshaw. And then then they were on their way to the Hillsborough County Jail out on Orion Road when the incident happened off the interstate.
Carr wasn't forthcoming about one pertinent detail. He gave police a false name. He identified himself as Joseph Lee Bennett. That was the name of Carl's girlfriend's ex, Joey's biological father.
Simultaneous to my being on the scene, I was working with a librarian in the Tribune's research library because the police department had released some information about the male involved in the situation. And he had provided a name and date of birth to the officers, and they had released that publicly. So one of the things at the time that we did pretty regularly was work with our researchers back in the office to run background checks on individuals to get more information about them. And I remember very vividly being at the scene, and I got a call back from the research librarian who said to me, "This doesn't make any sense, Sarah. This person does appear to exist, but it doesn't look like he's ever lived in Florida. It looks like he lives in Georgia."
Huntley recalled correctly that Bennett lived outside Marietta, but it was actually Marietta, Ohio. Huntley left East Crenshaw and headed to the Tribune's downtown office to begin crafting her story. Her first priority was to learn whatever she could about Joseph Lee Bennett and try to unlock the mystery that was nagging her. Meanwhile, Bell and Childers led the handcuffed car into the back seat of their unmarked Ford Taurus, and the three men headed toward the city jail. Carr was searched for weapons and was thought to have been clean, but he did have one piece of contraband on him that detectives didn't find. It was a tool Carr had been prepared to use for the very situation he'd found himself in. A handcuff key. One of the detectives earlier in the day had warned Carr against trying to free himself of his handcuffs. Grassi told me that Carr had proved to be a sneaky and stretchy suspect.
He was very limber, you know, and he had one of those guys that could be handcuffed in the back, and even with his hands cuffed in the back, run his arms under his legs and move his arms to the front. So some people can do that, and I think he had done that earlier in the day.
Carr's handcuffed hands were in his lap as he was riding in the back seat. The unmarked vehicle was rolling through the Tampa Heights neighborhood, and it turned on Floribrasca Avenue near the ramp for Interstate 275 when Carr made his move. Childers was driving. Bell was in the front passenger seat. Carr grabbed Childers' Glock pistol that was in his shoulder holster and shot Childers. Bell tried to dive over the front seat and grab the suspect, but Carr shot him. Both men were shot in the face. They died instantly. Childers' body was leaning against the driver's side door. Bell's body was lying across his seat. It was obvious that he had been reaching toward the back seat. Carr got out of the vehicle, unlocked the trunk, and retrieved the rifle that had been confiscated, the one that police thought was used to kill 4-year-old Joey. Carr was in possession of 2 handguns and a rifle. All he needed was a vehicle. He promptly carjacked a man who was driving by in a Ford Ranger. Carr made a quick visit to his mother's house, presumably to tell her goodbye. He made a pit stop at a gas station off I-75 and then got on the interstate heading north. It didn't take long for word to get out that 2 detectives were dead. The commotion caused people in the Tampa Heights neighborhood to come outside and investigate. The bloody scene caused many of them to turn away. Amidst the chaos, Grassi got a page.
We used to have pagers back then. They called them alpha pagers. And we used to get messages on this pager. It was a message that 2 people were shot in a carjacking on Floribrasca. And we were working the murder of the baby. And then it came out the 2 detectives were shot, and I didn't think it was, you know, my detectives because I thought I knew where everybody was. And then when I got there, I saw Detective Childers had his assigned detective's car was a green Ford Taurus, and which was unique because he was a Miami Dolphins fan and he had a Miami Dolphins plate on the front. Even though it was a police car, he had a little Dolphins tag on the front. And I saw that car, and I thought that was kind of strange that his car would be there. And then when I walked up to the car, they were both inside the car shot.
While this was unfolding, Huntley was hard at work trying to learn what she could about Hank Earl Carr, even though she didn't know his true identity. She was on the phone with the real Joseph Lee Bennett. She had to do the very thing every reporter never wants to do, and she had to juggle that task while the scanner next to her was blowing up with calls about the 2 slain detectives.
I remember this like it was yesterday. First of all, I found myself involved in an incredibly painful and awkward phone call, much to my dismay. I was on the phone with the gentleman in Georgia who turned out to be the child's father. I didn't know that at the time, and I was in a situation that I've always astutely tried to avoid as a reporter, which is telling somebody's next of kin that somebody they love has died. But that's exactly what I was in the midst of doing because I had stumbled my way into that. So it was that very same moment. I was having that conversation with this little boy's father who was obviously shocked to be hearing what I was telling him. And then I'm hearing on the scanner, you know, that they hit 2 officers were down.
Bennett was emotional on the phone. He was telling Huntley that he still had his children's Christmas gifts and he had been waiting to give them to Joey and Kayla. Huntley had her suspicions that the suspect in Joey's death had something to do with the carnage on Floribrasca Avenue, but she knew she had to focus on the conversation with Bennett.
I wasn't entirely sure that it was connected, but for something made me think oh my gosh, this is blowing up and this is all going to be connected. So I remember talking to this boy's father, who I obviously needed to continue to talk with. I couldn't just leave him in the state that I had inadvertently put him in, and give him, I was trying to give him information about who to contact at the police department. And I remember gesturing wildly to colleagues across the room, pointing to the scanner, trying to get their attention that we needed to get on that. A very strange confluence of events, and to this day, I remember my heart beating incredibly fast and just feeling like a sense of being overwhelmed.
Carr was traveling north on I-75 in the stolen pickup when Trooper James Crooks started tailing him. Carr had already crossed the Pasco County line. Crooks had activated his emergency lights and siren. He had no backup. As Carr approached the State Road 54 exit in Wesley Chapel, he pulled over his vehicle. He got out of the pickup, armed with a rifle, and ran toward Crooks, who had no time to get out. A witness watched as Carr headed toward the vehicle, but he was out of sight by the time he opened fire. That witness, who spoke to both the Times and the Tribune, said he heard two shots ring out. Both times, the shots were accompanied by the sounds of shattering glass. Crooks was fatally wounded. Carr got back into the truck and sped away. Here is Florida Highway Patrol Sergeant Steve Gaskins.
Trooper Crooks was trying to apprehend a violent person who had already done harm to a lot of other people. And there's going to be times, and unfortunately with the Highway Patrol, yes, we are spread out. We often work alone, and I know help was coming to him, and events just unfolded very rapidly, and the situation unfortunately left yet another person shot and killed by this one individual, and essentially this was an ambush.
The witness, who was on the scene, ran to the cruiser, which was inching forward because the exit ramp was a downward slope. The witness tried to put the vehicle in park, but it kept rolling, so he jumped inside and pressed his foot against the brake. The witness said this to the Tribune, quote, "I'll always remember the trooper's face. It was like he was looking back at me. When I had that car stopped and I looked at him, I couldn't believe it. It was like something you see in the movies." Crooks had been shot in the head. Carr continued north. At one point, he started shooting at other motorists. He fired one of his weapons at a semi-trailer. A bullet actually struck the driver in the arm. He was transported to a local hospital in serious condition. He survived his injuries. Carr also shot toward at least one Pasco sheriff's vehicle. The driver's side was struck by at least one bullet, but the sheriff's lieutenant, who was driving the car, wasn't injured. As the gunman approached Hernando County, authorities there were on high alert. Deputies parked their cars at the State Road 50 exit. They were lined up with rifles, waiting for Carr to emerge. In the meantime, a Hernando County Sheriff's helicopter was flying above the suspect's vehicle, presumably to notify the deputies on the ground of Carr's location. Carr grabbed his rifle and aimed it at the helicopter. One round struck the aircraft. It went through the floorboard and missed the pilot by mere inches. By the time he got within 100 yards of the State Road 50 overpass, Carr was finally outgunned. Several deputies opened fire, and that's where Carr suffered a bullet wound to his backside. He got off at the exit and headed toward the Shell station just west of the interstate. Meanwhile, back in Tampa, the news of Crooks' death added more stress to an environment that was already overflowing with it. News cameras picked up the image of a uniformed Tampa police officer talking on a cell phone. He held up three fingers and then made a gesture with his hand, notifying other police at the scene that a third cop had been fatally shot by the suspect. By that time, it was almost 3 p.m. Within 5 hours, a 4-year-old boy was dead. Two police detectives were dead. A trooper was dead, and a truck driver had been shot. Two other law enforcement officers also very nearly became casualties. It was a bloodbath, and it was far from over. Reporters at both major newspapers and all of the major TV news stations were on the story. Their bureaus in Pasco and Hernando were also scrambling.
I said, look, I really want to spend my time drilling down on who this actual suspect is. What do we know about him? So we ended up dividing and conquering and letting other reporters do the profiles of Ricky and Randy, and I gave them some insights that I had, and then I worked on developing the profile of Hank Earl Carr and who he actually was.
Reporters who got pulled into the fray began working on stories about the slain law enforcement officers. Detective Rick Childers was 46 years old. He was survived by his wife and two sons. A native of Plant City, he was known as Chili to prosecutors, who adored him. Among those prosecutors interviewed by the St. Pete Times about Childers was future Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. Childers had served with the Tampa Police Department for 19 years. He handled some of the agency's most notorious homicide cases. He had just wrapped up one case that required him to travel to New Jersey to obtain a confession from the suspect. He was named Officer of the Year in 1990 after saving a 17-year-old girl from a submerged car. Her vehicle had rolled into a murky creek during the middle of a storm, and Childers dove into the water with his flashlight and rescued the girl by smashing the driver's side window. Detective Randy Bell was 44 when he was killed. He was a native of Iowa, but his family moved to Tampa, where he graduated from high school. Days before he was killed, Bell had just been promoted to internal affairs. He and Childers were tight. It was Childers who joked to everyone that no one was ever allowed to talk to Randy again once his transfer to IA was complete. Bell, too, had helped solve some huge cases. He was ready for something different, something safer, something less dark. He had been a detective for 13 years and worked homicide cases for 10 years. His colleagues were planning a party for him to celebrate his promotion. Those at the state attorney's office also liked Bell. One prosecutor noticed Bell always took a gentler approach to suspects when he interviewed them. She asked him why he chose that tactic, and he told her, quote, "You have to treat people with respect and have people trust you." He was a man of his word. He was survived by a wife, three daughters, a stepson, a stepdaughter, and a grandson.
They were both great guys. I mean, Rick Childers and I, in 1983, got transferred to homicide together. While we were there, the homicide was busy, and they needed a couple of people, officers, to come over and help out. And he and I were in a tactical unit, and they asked us if we would go over there as a loan. And we went over, and we started working assault cases. And then when someone got promoted from there, they made me a detective. And then the next guy that got promoted, they made Childers a detective. But yeah, they were great guys. Rick was a really outgoing guy. Randy was a little more reserved. Solid guys, great detectives, good family men. And it was just, you see them every day. You work with them. You have coffee with them. You know, you have a beer with them. And then all of a sudden, it's on.
Huntley learned two developments at once. For starters, she was right. The suspect in Joey's death was responsible for the deaths of the two detectives. Then she learned who the detectives were. Her heart got even heavier.
I learned pretty quickly that my instincts were correct, that this was all connected. And I obviously knew that Ricky and Randy were the officers, the detectives working the case, because I had seen them at the scene. And so the other piece of this for me is that I obviously had developed somewhat of a working relationship with both detectives. I wouldn't say we were close, but I had worked with them in the past. And Ricky in particular had at one point pulled me aside and given me some sort of gruff advice on how to navigate the police beat. And then Randy was just a very outgoing, jovial person. He was very easy to like. So I was obviously grappling, as many reporters do when they have developed working relationships with sources, with a little bit of grief, right? right there on the spot about what had happened to these two people whom I admired.
Crooks was only 23 years old when he was killed. He was engaged to be married. He was survived by his parents. He had no children. A South Florida native, Crooks became the first and last trooper hired out of a pilot program that FHP had set up at the time. Other students attended the academy, but he was the only one hired. He basically paid his way through the agency's version of boot camp. Here again is Sergeant Gaskins.
A lot of the troopers I know were very hurt by the loss of Trooper Crooks. He was well known as a very outgoing, humorous type person. People enjoyed his personality. He'd only been a trooper for 8 to 9 months at the time, and he had worked extremely, extremely hard to get where he was at.
Here is Gaskins going into more detail about the long path Crooks took to becoming a trooper.
It's often treated very much like a military boot camp situation, trying to instill in you the values that we want Florida troopers to have. And Brad Crooks, of course, he didn't have to participate. He was in an internship program. He was paying for college and attending this on his own dime. A highly unusual situation. It hadn't happened before, and it hasn't happened since. But he paid his way basically through this academy, where the other recruits, enduring all the same issues that he had to endure to get through the academy, they were being paid to do so. They were starting to accumulate their benefits, things of that nature. And so he did all this on his own. And his efforts, you know, he didn't shrink from any of the assignments he was given. And for that, I think he was highly respected from that aspect alone. Not to mention that, you know, people just liked him. He was a great guy, and they enjoyed being with him, friendly, helpful, you know, a team player. These are all aspects that we look forward to be a trooper.
Gaskin said Crooks' relatives have not remained in contact with FHP for several years. They remain deeply hurt by the loss. In an article recently published by the Tampa Bay Times, Crooks had lost 60 pounds to pass the fitness test that he needed to pass to become a trooper. The article also stated that Crooks' mother died in 2007. His father is still alive, but he declines invitations to attend memorials. He doesn't find them therapeutic. Too much sadness comes back. A stretch of State Road 54 was dedicated in Crooks' honor. A reason authorities weren't fully aware of who they were dealing with was the direct result of the cunning nature of Carr himself. He threw them off the scent of his checkered background by giving them a false name. He acted as though he was distraught over the death of Joey, telling police he had tried to take away the weapon after he saw Joey dragging it behind him. Carr said the butt of the rifle struck the wall and a round went off. It was one of a string of lies, he told investigators.
It quickly emerged that this was a troubling character with a long history. You know, and I was doing criminal background checks and getting a sense that he was not somebody to take lightly by any means. Very violent past and violent history. And it's understandable to me why he would want to assume the persona of the little boy's dad when talking to officers, because they would be much more disarmed by that persona than by who the real Hank Earl Carr was.
Carr's profile was about to get a lot less vague to authorities. Law enforcement officers were about to listen in on a series of heart-to-heart conversations with the killer, who was bleeding, feeling defeated, and turning fatalistic. Marissa Bell Kelly was a crisis negotiator for the Hernando County Sheriff's Office. Once Carr pulled off the highway, took a pregnant woman hostage, and barricaded himself behind the counter of the gas station that was encased with bulletproof glass, she became the point person tasked with putting an end to the violence. Kelly told me she was preparing for the worst as she watched the news and listened to the scanner reports of Carr heading north towards State Road 50.
Once he pulled off our exit, several of us automatically went there, not necessarily thinking that we were going to negotiate, but because there was a standoff at that intersection, and we just responded just in case and responded to help out as much as I could with whatever was going to occur.
Carr, with a bullet hole in his buttocks, crashed the pickup into a drainage ditch near the building. He managed to limp his way inside the gas station. He fired bullets at pursuing deputies who were trying to get close to him. The only other person inside was 27-year-old Stephanie Kramer of Dade City. She would remain in there with him for more than 4 hours. Kelly set up a makeshift command center inside a hotel room down the street from the gas station. She occupied one room while scene commanders took another. Nothing about the scene was anything like Kelly had experienced before.
Initially, when I drove up to the scene, to me, the enormity of what I was getting myself ready to get into was crushing. I felt the pressure of all these law enforcement that were out there when I drove up. It looked like a war zone. I'd never seen so many police in one place in my entire life. And everybody had weapons. And as I drove through the maze of law enforcement and cars and command centers and everything, the pressure was crushing. And I knew that my life after today was going to change. In what way, I didn't know, but I knew that it was going to be different from that day on and that this was big. And when I went in that room, I was ready for the task, whatever the results were.
Kelly may have been locked in on the task at hand, but she noticed there were more people than normal hovering around. She had to deal with commanders from another police department watching her closely, and they weren't treating this like a regular hostage negotiation.
It was an unusual situation for any other negotiation, because normally you don't have command in the next room. You don't have detectives that are feeling deep pain in the same room with you. And then they had their negotiators and they wanted to negotiate instead of me. And there was a lot of pressure just in the room itself.
Anyone in her position had to know how to talk, listen, read, and interpret sign language all at the same time. She had to conduct a phone conversation with an unstable suspect, all while getting orders from her scene commanders. It was sensory overload inside that hotel room.
They, you know, were passing notes and sign language, and, you know, we had eraser boards there. So they would inform, you know, I'd be not only negotiating with him, but I'd be looking at this board as they're telling me what's going on outside, which way to steer the conversation.
The early stage of a negotiation is, at least in one respect, the most challenging. Suspects usually take some time before they're willing to pick up the phone, let alone stay connected for an extended conversation.
Normally, in my experience, every time I negotiate it, the perp always hangs up, and it's several times before they stay on, and they always want to hang up and think about it. Or if they promise you something, like giving up Stephanie, they want to think about it, or they want to talk to their mother. Or so there was a lot of interruptions, but the longest interruption was in the very beginning when we're trying to establish rapport.
The interruption came from a surprising outside party. A Tampa-based radio station. Don Richards was the radio director at WFLA 970 AM. He got the number to the Shell station from the phone book and dialed the number. He got through to Carr. That phone conversation made it to the air. I found almost no traces of it on the internet, nor could I obtain a digital recording of it. Some copies of the conversation are still floating around, but they're mainly on cassette tape. Richards and the station received a lot of criticism for that interview. Reports showed that the St. Petersburg Times also called the station and spoke with Carr briefly. Huntley listened to the radio interview from the Tribune office. She had to make a decision on whether to follow suit. It wasn't a hard one for her to make.
And the other piece that I remember very vividly is a conversation with my editor about what do we do to cover what's happening at the gas station. And how do we handle that, knowing that it was, at that point in time, a live hostage situation? And I actually had tracked down, you know, phone number for the gas station. And I remember we had a conversation about, should I call the gas station? Should I see if I can get somebody in the gas station? And you may recall, Tony, that my competition did do that. And they spoke briefly to Mr. Carr. I actually made a decision that to this day I continue to be proud of, to not try to roust Mr. Carr on the phone. I knew from lots of conversations with law enforcement that he probably needed a platform, that he probably wanted to talk to his girlfriend, and that giving him that opportunity, I feared, would put the hostages at more risk. So it was a restrained decision, you know, in journalism ranks. I'm not sure that everybody would agree with the decision I made, but I feel like it was the right thing to do. This all happened in the span of, you know, 8 hours. I had walked into a situation where I had just told a father that his child was gone. I was dealing with the issue of having two people who I deeply admired being killed. And then I was going to get into the situation where I could potentially be putting a hostage at more risk than she already was. That didn't seem like a good set of events to me. So at that point, I decided to back off a little bit on that aspect.
Police were not happy with WFLA or the Times. Kelly certainly wasn't.
We were watching the news too, because there was televisions in the room, and that's when we found out that he was on the air, and that's why we couldn't get in on the by calling him, and we were pretty disgusted.
Richard straddled the line between journalist and negotiator.
You know, the best advice I can give you would be to let that lady who has nothing to do with any of this out of that store.
Here is a portion of that recorded conversation between Carr and Richards. It was later aired during an episode of World's Wildest Police Videos. In this clip, you can hear the suspect plainly describe what he did to Childers and Bell, as well as his reluctance to go to prison.
I got one of the handcuffs off. I reached up front and got the pistol away from the officer that was driving. I shot them both. I know I'm frying for the cops. I don't want to try in the electric chair. I don't want to go to prison. I don't want to have to eat the food. I don't want to have to live with people. I don't want to go to prison. I don't want to go.
Kelly shared with me the audio of her conversation with Carr. Early on, while she was building that critical rapport, she tried to convince him not to accept any more calls from the media.
And then I couldn't get back through.
Right, people have been calling up here from the news and all kinds of
stuff. Oh, man, you don't want to talk to them right now.
I just wanted everybody to know it was an accident.
Oh, yeah, well, I can understand that.
Kelly got an earful from Carr about Joey's death. He remained insistent that the shooting was an accident.
I never shot my son on purpose. I didn't even know the gun was loaded. It was unloaded the night before. I don't know where the bullet came from. Yeah.
But it was an accident. I feel like shit. I don't even think I should live.
No. I want you to live. I mean, we got things that you can work through, and you do have your wife, and you have your other daughter.
Carr also described the conversations he had with the two Tampa detectives, and members of the Tampa Police Department were listening in on the conversation.
Oh, he's beautiful too. What? Cute little bugger. I bet he was.
I'm so sorry.
I know you are.
So sorry.
I know, but it was an accident.
That's what I thought, Tom, and they were calling me a liar and all kinds of shit. They tried to act like me and her got into some kind of fight or something. And the cop goes, oh, well, did she shield herself with the child and you shot him anyway or something? And I was like, no way, man, it was an accident.
Yeah.
I mean, I immediately grabbed him up and ran for medical assistance. It was just too late. He was shot point blank in the face. And I feel so bad.
I bet you do. It's a lot of things that you have to work through.
At one point, Carr agreed to give the phone to his hostage, Stephanie Kramer. Kelly started giving her instructions.
Hello, Stephanie?
Yes.
How are things?
Okay.
All right. How's he treating you?
very good. He's very nice.
Is he? That's good.
He's a very nice man.
Okay, well, you just be real nice to him, okay?
Of course.
Okay. I am sure you're really a nervous wreck, but just be strong, okay?
Okay.
We're working for you here.
Okay.
All right? All right.
Kelly wanted to know about Carr's injuries, so she kept Stephanie on the phone and asked her to describe how badly her kidnapper was hurt.
Is he bleeding a lot?
Yeah, he's bleeding.
Really?
Yeah, all we have are clothes to put on it.
Okay, are you putting something on his wound?
No, he said he just found the bullet.
All right. Is he shot in his back, like he said?
It's in his butt and...
Oh, went through his butt and then in his back?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And so is he sitting down?
Yeah, he's sitting down.
Okay. Does he look like these injuries he'll be passing out anytime soon?
No, I know he is weak.
He is, okay.
He's weak and he's in pain. I know it hurts him. I can see it.
Okay. Well, you be real sympathetic with him and we're going to get you out of there, okay?
Okay.
After the ordeal, Stephanie Kramer was resentful for the way law enforcement handled the situation. That's what Kelly told me. The audio clips reveal a woman who was harboring sympathy for the man who had put her in the middle of a dangerous situation. The Stockholm Syndrome seemed to be taking a hold of her.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Just say yes or no, okay? Are the guns on him?
No.
Okay, are they on the counter?
Yes.
Okay. Do they have bullets in them? That you know of?
Yes, no.
One. Okay.
Gave me one gun.
He gave you one gun?
Yes, I've got it in my hand.
Okay. Is it unloaded?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
So he told me I'm looking at it, so I don't see anything in it.
Okay, but that doesn't mean that there isn't anything in it.
Very nice. I don't think he knows I don't like guns, so I don't think he'd give me a loaded gun.
Okay. Well, be careful. That doesn't mean that particular gun is unloaded, okay?
He just took everything out of it, and it's not loaded at all.
Okay, is the chamber open then?
Chamber is open. I can see in it. He just took whatever they called it.
Okay, I'm going to ask him if he'll let you go. Will you think he'll let you go?
He wants to talk to his wife.
Okay, before he lets you go?
Yes.
Before he lets me go, that's what he wants.
Okay, and the gun that has a bullet in it is on the counter?
Yes.
Is he near it now?
Yes.
Okay.
We definitely going to try to get you out. And,
he said please keep the cops back away from here.
Okay. They're not going to move in. They're going to stay right where he sees them.
Okay.
Okay, I can't ask him to move back any further. But if he works with us, we can work with him.
He said that they'll stay right where they're at. They won't come any closer. And if you work with them, they'll work with you. So thank you.
Okay. I'm going to do the best for him, okay?
Okay.
All right. I don't want to hang up because I don't want to...
They told us to keep the line open because they were going to try to get in touch with him for his wife.
As you just heard from the hostage, Carr had a singular demand for the crisis negotiator, aside from cops staying a certain distance from the building. Carr wanted to speak to his girlfriend, Bernice Bowen, who he kept referring to as his wife. Additionally, Kelly knew Carr's real identity, but she continued to call him Joe, the name he originally gave detectives. Kelly relied on her training to keep the suspect calm and agreeable. Bowen was flown in. She was kept inside a third hotel room.
She was in a third hotel room, and I did meet with her on one of my breaks, and she was briefed on what she should address, what she should not address. She was warned that if she were to go off script, that she would be pulled off immediately, and the goal was to get Stephanie out and ultimately have Carr come out.
Kelly, right away, picked up on Carr's narcissistic streak.
It was all about him and what a victim he was and why everybody else made him do what he did. So you try to listen to him because the trick is to listen. If he's talking, let him talk. You pick out what you think is important to him that means something to him, and you try to find that hook.
The standoff didn't appear it was going to end anytime soon. Carr promised he would let Stephanie go, but he also understood the longer he kept her in there, the longer he could keep the SWAT team at bay. He also had all the food and drinks and cigarettes he ever wanted.
He was behind the counter, pretty much immobile because of that one leg. And he was using Stephanie to get him drinks. And, you know, they had all the food they needed in there. And, I mean, it could have been a standoff for days because there was enough sustenance in there. I could hear him asking her to, you know, bandage him up. And she was compliant.
Kelly was prepared for a long wait. She could tell Carr understood the situation.
Usually they let the hostage go when they're ready, no matter how many times you ask to let her out and no matter how many times you negotiate something to have him let her go. It's a process. It's not one particular incident or conversation that gets her out. It's a process. And when he was ready, he wrote some letters, he spoke to his mother, and to me, these were all goodbyes. I personally did not think that he was going to come out, because he told me during the negotiations, there's nothing for him. You know, he killed three cops, he knew he killed three cops, he knew he was going to jail for life or death, and he wasn't willing to go.
As the hours ticked by, it was becoming increasingly difficult for the Tampa police officers in that command center to stay calm. Kelly had to share the phone for a while with a Tampa police officer. He continued telling Carr to let the hostage go. Carr was getting more agitated by his demands. In turn, the police officer was getting more agitated, and he snapped at Carr. Kelly still remembers that.
It did happen. He wasn't yelling, but it was very forceful. You better do this or whatever. And it went bad because, again, they wanted to negotiate it. So he was allowed to talk to him, but they didn't have that rapport. So that didn't work.
it very nearly went sideways on you. So after that, the commanders on the scene took him off and put you back on, right?
Yes. Yes. I'm glad they did that because I thought we were doing the entire Hernando County Sheriff's Office is doing a great job. And, you know, we might be up here in Brooksville and all that, but, you know, we're trained, and maybe for not something of that magnitude, but it's just me and Carr. That's all that I care about, and Stephanie getting her out. So that was my only job.
Grassi told me that managing that emergency during a period of intense sadness was challenging for everyone.
Well, at the time, it was the first time the Tampa Police Department had ever lost two officers at the same time. It was very tough. It was tough on the police department. It was tough on everybody. It was hard for everybody to, certainly hard for us to manage and continue to work. And because we still had to continue to work homicides and we still had to continue to work police shootings. And we had a couple of days to grieve, but then we had to go back and take care of the business that we were there for.
More than 170 law enforcement officers had surrounded that gas station. Tampa Police, Pasco Sheriff's Office, Florida Highway Patrol, and the Hernando County Sheriff's Office all had a presence in that little corner next to the interstate. Before long, Carr was ready to let Stephanie go. That also meant he was ready to die. That was apparent during his last conversation with his girlfriend. Bowen pleaded with him to stay alive.
Baby, don't ever let us be together.
Yes, they will, baby.
No, I'll sit in jail for years and years.
No, I'll still be able to get to see your face and hear your voice, and that's what matters to me. And if that doesn't matter to you, then you really don't love me.
No, oh, don't say that. You know I love you.
Baby, do not do anything stupid.
Think I can live after what I've done today.
It was an accident. I love you. Please don't do anything stupid. I love you.
Stay strong, because you're going to have to go on without
please
me.
Please don't. I need you.
Do me a favor.
Baby.
Do me a favor. Please quit begging me not to, because I'm going to.
Please don't.
The couple kept talking. Meanwhile, the SWAT members outside were preparing to blow out a wall and make their move.
Listen.
Don't do this to me.
Listen, okay?
Don't do this to me.
Quit saying that.
Don't do me?
Quit saying that.
Kick it out of your reach.
Don't be calm.
I don't care. Kick it out of your reach. I love you, baby.
Listen.
Please.
Quit talking about the gun.
I'm not talking about the gun. You kick it out of your reach and I know you're safe.
And you'll just shut up?
I'm about to shut up until you straighten up.
All right, listen. I'm straightening up, okay? But you gotta listen to me, all right? I love you, baby, and I'm sorry for what I did.
Okay, baby, they've even agreed to give me a drug fuel business, okay? See?
Listen.
We can be able to see each other.
Listen. All that bullshit. Tell them to quit talking to you.
Baby, I don't care.
Listen.
Listen to me. I love you.
Please let me get these last few words out.
No, I'm not, because you're not going to do anything stupid. I'm going to sit here and keep throwing a fit until you fly right.
Boy, keep throwing a fit. I'm just going to hang up the phone and shoot myself.
No, you're not.
Authorities were aghast as they listened to and watched Bowen. She was so emotional for the man who had just killed her son. She showed no such emotion for Joey. During this next portion of the conversation, Carr realized he didn't have much time left. It was getting smoky inside. The smoke was coming from the tear gas canisters. Here are the last words of Hank Earl Carr.
Please, baby, I love you. Please don't do nothing to me. Baby, please. But I beg of you. I'm on my hands and knees right now. Pray to God that you don't, okay? I love you and I need you.
Baby, I can't.
If I can't hold you, I can at least hear your voice and help. You can help me get through this.
Baby.
You need to help me.
I wrote a letter to my mom telling her to help you out any way she can.
Care,
you understand?
Don't do this.
There's a suitcase at Mama's. I want you to have everything in it.
Don't do this.
Okay? One day, I want you to tell my daughter how much I love her.
Boo, don't do this.
Begging me to quit.
It doesn't make a difference, Boo. Your daughter's going to see that her daddy was a punk pussy boy and blowed his f***ing head off, okay? That's what she's going to see. And she's going to think my daddy was weak, okay? So don't be stupid. And don't
worry. No, I'm not. They just busted something.
Boo, I love you. Don't be stupid.
They just busted off a gas bomb in here or something.
Boo, they did not. I love you. Don't do nothing stupid, please.
I'm dying. Here I go. I love you. I love you with all my heart, baby.
That was it. The siege was over just before sundown. The 10-hour horror had ended. Carr was the last to die. It took a while for the chaos outside to taper off, but inside that command center, the ending was far more abrupt.
I put the phone down. I said he killed himself, and everybody just sits there exhausted and numb in the room. It's like, okay, it's over.
The story dominated the next day's front pages. Police told the media the day after the killings that Carr got out of his cuffs using a hidden key. From then on, Tampa police changed their policy, requiring that prisoners be handcuffed behind their backs. A fog hovered over that department for days and weeks. The funeral for Childers and Bell was held inside the Tampa Convention Center. More than 7,000 people attended.
It was just a time that you look back on now and it's just kind of a blur. You don't realize the emotional scarring that you have from that day and things that stay with you for the rest of your life. So, you know, the day it happened, the days afterwards, the funeral, the aftermath, and how things played out, it was just an event that changed my life.
In 1962, President John F. Kennedy signed a proclamation making May 15th Peace Officers Memorial Day. From that came National Police Week. And every year, police departments across the country hold memorial services for fallen heroes. They're held almost simultaneously with the anniversaries of the deaths of Randy Bell, Ricky Childers, and James Crooks. The Tampa Police Department held a memorial Saturday for Childers and Bell. After Carr died, Bowen was charged. She had been questioned earlier that day by police after Bell, Childers, and Crooks were slain, and she refused to cooperate. She was charged as an accessory to the murders and served more than 18 years in prison. She was released in October 2016 at the age of 42. She moved to East Canton, Ohio, to live with her parents. Her daughter, Kayla, was raised by her maternal grandparents, according to an article in the Tampa Bay Times. In that same article, police pointed out that when Carr drove Joey to that fire station, Bowen was with them. But instead of sitting in the back seat with her dying son, she sat in the front with the man who shot him. Police saw that as another indication of how heartless of a mother she was. The attorney who defended Bowen in 1998 told the Times that she got a bum rap. She was victimized by Carr and then by the state. Bowen's father thought the same. He said the state of Florida got its pound of flesh when authorities locked up his daughter for the better part of two decades. It was also learned that Joey Bennett was removed from his home in Ohio by Bowen and Carr. The boy never should have been in that household. Huntley remembers how the community mourned the loss of the victims, but she suggested to me that more attention probably should have been given to the first of Carr's victims that day.
This was absolutely devastating to have two officers from Tampa killed in the line of duty and then a third officer. I remember that the community was very shaken, and immediately the outpourings of support for the police began. Sometimes I feel like the fact that a toddler child lost his life too got a little bit lost in the mix, but that's obviously an incredibly tragic and sad event in and of itself.
First responders like Kelly and Grassi and others who dealt with the pain of losing their comrades suffered lasting trauma. To a lesser degree, but still to a degree that can't be downplayed, reporters who covered that day's events suffered too.
So, you know, this was one of those seminal experiences for me as a reporter and as a human being, in that I realized very acutely that day that the objectivity or the distance that reporters are supposed to apply is sometimes challenging. And I remember late in the night, after I finally left the newsroom, I actually went to a colleague's apartment. She lived in the same apartment complex as me. I could not just go back to my house. I was going to pace all night long, you know. So I went back and, you know, sat down with her, and we just talked about how emotionally draining it was. She subsequently wrote a piece for Columbia Journalism Review about that. And I also remember the next day going in and having a conversation with the editors and saying, you know, I think that this might not be the only person going through some of these issues, and can we bring somebody in to talk to the reporters? And they did do that.
Huntley's next career stop was at a newsroom comprised of various reporters who endured an even higher profile massacre.
It was really interesting because subsequent to my career at the Tribune, I went to work at the Rocky Mountain News, and I was not at the Rocky for Columbine, but I had a number of colleagues who had worked through that horrible situation and had very similar emotional reactions, perhaps even more acute than mine. And the Rocky had brought a counselor in. And I remember that there was some conversations about reporters don't really like to acknowledge that they're vulnerable as well. You know, we have this sort of stiff upper lip, we're going to tell you what's going on and that's our mission. And it was around, you know, for me, it was this case. For others, it was many, you know, the school shootings cases and other cases. 9/11 was another example where I think the industry began to realize that there is, I don't necessarily want to go so far as to say a PTSD factor, but there is an impact on people who are immersing themselves in those situations. Much like first responders, reporters are sending themselves out, running toward really horrible situations. And you have to realize that at some point that takes a toll.
Kelly's law enforcement career spanned three decades. She retired from the Hernando County Sheriff's Office in 2008. The standoff near I-75 is the one that caused her the most pain, literally. She told me that the post-traumatic stress she had stacked up during her career caused her to have a breakdown. she felt a physical ache once she reached that tipping point, and the incident that came into the sharpest focus was the one involving Hank Earl Carr.
This one took the heaviest toll. And to this day, what affects me is every time an officer gets killed, it automatically brings me back to this incident. And that's why for several years I didn't want to talk about it anymore. Every time an officer dies, I feel it intensely. Not that any other officer or law enforcement officer, I'm sure they all feel it too, but as me as an individual, I feel every death. And I don't even know these people, and I get very emotional, because from the deaths of those three officers, you know, you learn about their lives. I learned about their lives and their families and their children, and it was just so unnecessary.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week when I will discuss the case that inspired a Hollywood film, Pain and Gain, starring Mark Wahlberg and Dwayne Johnson. The story involves a South Florida bodybuilder who led a crew in an elaborate kidnapping of a Miami businessman who was forced to sign over all of his worldly possessions to his captors. The gang also committed a grisly double murder. My special guest for that segment will be Miami Herald reporter David Avaye. Join us then.
You can find Tony on Twitter at TonyCrimeWriter or email him at tony.holt@news-jrnl.com. Be sure to rate us on iTunes. Sun Crime State is recorded by Tony Holt and produced by Chris Bridges for the Daytona Beach News Journal.